The judges of the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals draw near, for the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. Court is called to order. The court calls the case United States versus Miller, ACM number 38922. Appellant presents two issues for our consideration during argument. They are whether the military judge erred by admitting text messages as a fresh complaint and a prior consistent statement, and whether the acquittal under a rule for courts martial 917 of the words on diverse occasions in specification 2 and 3 of the charge rendered the subsequent verdict to those specifications ambiguous under United States v. Walters, thereby precluding this court from conducting its review under Article 6060. Appellant's counsel, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
5 minutes, Your Honor.
5 minutes. Very well. You may proceed.
Good morning, members of the court. My name is Bill Cassara. Judge Harding, it's good to see you again. I think the last time we saw each other was at Barksdale Air Force Base, if my memory serves me correctly, but I could be wrong. Senior Judge Gabriski, Judge Brown. My name is Bill Cassara, and along with Major Jonathan Lake, we represent the appellant in this case, Master Sergeant Todd Miller. As the senior judge stated, we are arguing two issues today. The first of those is that the military judge erred by admitting text messages as a fresh complaint and a prior consistent statement. As the court knows, the standard of review in this case is that a military judge's decision to admit or exclude evidence of a prior consistent statement is reviewed for an abuse of discretion. I'd like to take just a minute to sort of give the court sort of a historical background to help frame the argument of both the fresh complaint rule and the prior consistent statement rule. Under the old manual, under paragraph 142 Charlie of the 1969 manual for courts martial, provided for a fresh complaint where a victim made a complaint, quote, within a reasonable time. That's going to become important as we discuss this issue a little bit down the road. It is admissible for purposes of corroboration. The victim's credibility need not have been attacked under the old rule. It was restricted to proof that the complaint was made, and the details of the complaint were inadmissible. Paragraph 153 alpha said that a conviction cannot be based on the uncorroborated testimony of a victim in a sexual assault case if the testimony is self-contradictory, uncertain, or improbable. A fresh complaint was a means of corroboration. Now, as the court knows, as we got to rape shield laws and as the rules began to develop, the new rule was that there was no longer a fresh complaint rule under the new manual. And you must look to other military rules of evidence, for example, MRE 801 D1 Bravo, for a prior consistent statement as one example. One of the cases cited by the military judge in this case was United States versus Sandoval, a case decided under the old rule. And it recognized that the old rule was premised on the necessity for admitting the fact of the complaint in sex crimes because of the unique circumstances that the sex crime be corroborated. And that was at 18 MJ 61. And the court said that there would have been little occasion for the military rules of evidence to have eliminated only the corroboration requirement and retained the provision for a fresh complaint or vice versa. In the case at bar, the military judge gave lip service to the new rule but actually applied the old rule and in fact stated he was applying the old rule. He sought to determine whether the statements, i.e. the text messages, were made within a reasonable time. He found as a matter of fact and law that the text messages were made within a reasonable time of the allegations, again, citing the rule from the old fresh complaint requirement. He concluded that J.H. reached out to Ms. Brooks, her friend, at a time when the alleged offenses still evoked strong emotions from her. Again, language from the old rule. He concluded that the principle of fresh complaint is extended to MRE 801, which suggests that he thought, the military judge, that he could substitute the old reasonable time requirement for some of all of the requirements in the of a prior consistent statement. There is simply no authority in the law for what the military judge did. So now I'd like to look at the prior consistent statement requirement under MRE 801 D1 Bravo, which states that a statement is not hearsay if it is consistent with the declarant's testimony and offered to rebut an express or implied charge of a recent fabrication or an improper influence or motive. This timing requirement comes from United States versus McCaskey, as cited in our brief, CMA case from 1990, and in which McCaskey states, our Superior Court states, that a rule that defines what otherwise would be hearsay as not hearsay should be narrowly read and strictly applied.
Counsel,
yes, Your Honor.
You seem to argue in your brief that there has to be some express allegation of misrepresentation or improper influence. I think you used the term, it must be determined by the appellant's allegation of when the motive arose. But doesn't that, I mean, it conflicts with what boy, the rule says, and the rule says it can be an express or an implied. So do you agree that it can be an implied suggestion?
Okay. Absolutely, Your Honor. The prior statement must have been made, and this is very important, Senior Judge, as a follow-up, must have been made before the point at which the story was fabricated or the improper influence of motive arose. Otherwise, it does not rebut the charge of recent fabrication. And you'll recall the language in the McCaskey case, which says, simply saying the same thing over and over again does not constitute a fabrication. The party opponent of the statement is in the driver's seat. The focus is not when or even if a recent fabrication, improper influence, or improper motive occurred. As stated in United States versus Faison, CAF case from 1998, the rule is concerned with rebutting the express or implied charge, i.e. the accusation by the party opponent that some impropriety occurred. The point in time is to be ascertained for the purposes of rebuttal is a fair implication of the charge, not the underlying event, which is what the military judge said it was in this case, and that's the Faison case. The merely assailing a witness's testimony by cross-examination does not afford an opportunity to corroborate them by proof of a prior consistent statement, and that's the Kellum case. Nothing short of actual impeachment warrants corroboration of the witness by hearsay testimony. Now, in the instant case, the military judge focused on the fact of the cross-examination itself. And with all due respect to the military judge, the triggering event cannot be determined by J.H.'s testimony. It is determined by the appellant's allegation of when the motive to fabricate arose. The appellant did not make any allegation in this case that there was a motive to fabricate. The military judge focused on bias and cross-examination, ignores Faison's requirement that the point of time to be ascertained is the fair implication of the charge, not the arguable underlying event.
Counsel,
yes,
at the start of the cross-examination, the defense counsel went through the victim on that she had reviewed previous statements, that she was aware of the defense strategy, so to speak, at trial. She had consulted with trial counsel multiple times. She had consulted with her SVC. What is the purpose of that questioning if it's not to imply that she had some improper influence or she had tried to mold her testimony or her testimony was coached?
Okay. So, and obviously, Judge, that's the crux of the argument in this case. And I think that the defense counsel in this case made it very clear that the purpose of that cross-examination was to show that the defense had less access to the alleged victim than the government did. In fact, the defense made it very clear that at no point were they alleging, in fact, I think they said, you know, we are black and white, not alleging that she fabricated, we're not alleging that there was an improper motive. But I think it's important for the court to realize that if there was a motive to fabricate in this case, if there was an improper influence or bias, that motive arose before the first text messages, or at least contemporaneous with when the first text message was written, which I think was a text message that says, when are you going to be awake, or something along those lines.
So what is that motive then? So what are you alleging that motive would be at that point?
Again, Your Honor, the defense's position has continually been and continues to be that there was no motive to fabricate. But my point is that even if the court were to disagree and say, well, we think that there is a motive to fabricate, that motive had to have arrived temporally at before, or at least contemporaneous with, the first text message.
Counsel, what about the implied improper influence of meeting
I'm sorry,
with
Judge,
what
I'm
about
sorry.
The implied improper influence or motive of meeting with counsel and almost saying getting your story straight by meeting with counsel multiple times, meeting with your SVC, being interviewed? Wouldn't that have arose after the 12 hours, that text message that occurred after 12 hours?
It would have, Judge, but again, the defense position was that there was nothing, that they weren't alleging that was improper. They were merely alleging or merely stating that they had less access to the witness than the government did. And that at some point temporally, whether it was immediately then, you know, before that text message, but it certainly wasn't at cross-examination, as the military judge said, what we had in this case
was the alleged victim conflating a dream into reality. But at no point did they allege that there was a motive to fabricate, an improper influence, or an improper motive on her part.
The military judge focused on bias, and he said, and his focus on bias in the cross-examination ignores the Faison requirement that the point in time is the fair implication of the charge, not the arguable underlying event. I'd like to turn, I think it's pretty obvious, Your Honor, that as far as the prejudice requirement, the text messages were hearsay, not falling within any exception, and were the only corroboration of J.H.'s testimony. Absent the text messages, I believe that there is little question in this case that the appellant would have been acquitted. In response to the government's brief, I think that they've raised a couple of issues that we would like to discuss very briefly. The government says that Morgan and Jones stand for the proposition that cross-examination alone opens the door to a prior consistent statement. They don't. In fact, Your Honors, to take that argument to its very logical extension, the exception would then consume the rule. All cross-examination would open the door, and we would simply start trials with saying, if you're going to cross-examine the victim, we're going to put in every statement that she's ever made or he or she has ever made to OSI or anybody else. In Morgan, the defense sought to have the witness testify that she told, quote, the same story over and over again. In this case, we merely pointed out that J.H. had cooperated with the government but not the defense, and the defense was therefore at a tactical disadvantage because it did not have the same level of access. Also, the defense pointed out inconsistency in J.H.'s trial testimony in Article 32, but unlike Morgan, the inconsistencies were not accompanied by a charge of coaching or recent fabrication, and in fact, such an allegation was expressly denied by the defense.
But the fact that the defense believed they didn't raise the issue of improper influence or bias is not really the question we're here to look at. We're looking at the record and deciding whether or not those questions would have raised the ability of the military judge to view those as a allegation of improper influence or improper motive. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely, Judge.
Okay.
But I think, I'm sorry, Judge, did you have something else
to say?
No, go
ahead, please.
Okay. I think what's important to note, Judge, is that while normally you would give the military judge's findings some discretion in this case or some leeway, I don't think you can do that in this case because he did not put his findings as it relates to a prior consistent statement on the record. He clearly applied the wrong standard. So the defense is not given the opportunity to rebut, so to speak, in court, the military judge's decision because he was giving them a wrong rationale for that decision.
And your basis for that is because the judge, I mean, obviously in his ruling he cited 801D for a prior consistent statement. It's just the fact that he somehow incorporated the fresh complaint?
He applied the fresh complaint. I would say he went much more than incorporated it.
Okay.
He applied the fresh complaint. The Jones case, conversely, was decided before Ms. McCaskey, so its application is limited to this case. The Jones court said the proponent of the witness impeached thereby may then rehabilitate the witness by introducing a prior consistent statement given before the event which is alleged to have resulted in fabrication. It did not say that cross-examination itself triggers the application of the rule, and indeed, to take that to its logical conclusion would subsume the rule. Any cross-examination would then do so. The government says the military judge didn't admit the text messages solely because they formed a fresh complaint under Sandoval. Respectfully, there is no other way to interpret what the military judge said. He said, quote, the principle of fresh complaint is extended to MRE 801. The theory of admissibility of a fresh complaint is that it is natural to expect that the victim of such a crime would complain of it and prosecution can show the fact of complaint to forestall the assumption that none was made and therefore the defense did not occur. He said, quote, this is a fresh complaint. He said the statements were, quote, made within a reasonable time of the allegations. He said the statements were made, quote, at a time when the alleged offenses still evoke strong emotions. All of these are direct from the language of the now, of the no longer in effect fresh complaint rule. His military judge's invocation of MRE 801 D1B simply doesn't save it. The military judge used MRE 801 D1B as a vehicle for evidence that he saw as a fresh complaint, but otherwise, as he stated very previously in his prior rulings, did not comport with the hearsay rule, and we're not a hearsay exception. Subject to any further questions from the court on assignment of error one?
So, counsel, I just ask this one question.
Yes, sir.
Supposing that the judge did err in his theory of admissibility, but yet there was a proper theory of admissibility. In other words, there was an improper motive and implication, regardless of the intent of the defense, such that 801D would apply. Doesn't that basically moot any prejudice that's attached to the erroneous ruling or fresh complaint?
I would disagree, Judge. I think what you're asking is, what if he got the right result for the wrong reason?
Yes.
And the reason why I would disagree with that, Judge, is because I was saying earlier in response to Senior Judge's question, it denies the defense the opportunity of, at trial, pointing out, going into the record, it possibly introducing other evidence to show that the prior consistent statement rule does not apply.
Well, but they did at that point, because on reconsideration they went back and actually came up with a motive for the victim to fabricate. So, I mean, they did come back on the record, even though they alleged earlier there was no motive to fabricate. They came back and argued that, in fact, her attention-seeking behavior was now a motive to fabricate. So they did get the ability to come back and at least ask the judge to revisit that opinion.
They did, Judge, but you'll also recall that they said that there were other avenues of attack that they had planned on taking in that case, directly attacking her credibility, directly attacking her motive to fabricate, that they did not do based on the military judge's prior rulings. And they continually said, this is not a motive to fabricate. And I understand the judge's concern about, you know, what if we can read that into the record. But the bottom line is, you cannot give the military judge's ruling deference in this case, because he was arguing or discussing the case with the defense counsel from the standpoint of a fresh complaint, as opposed to the standpoint of a prior consistent statement.
But counsel, he puts on the record the reason why he believes that 801D1B applies. He says what defense counsel did to open the door to those prior consistent statements. It's right in his ruling.
As well as his discussion about the fresh complaint. It is simply, respectfully, from this appellant's perspective, it is impossible to understand which of the two different standards the military judge applied in reaching his ruling, because he said both. Moving on to the Walters issue, as the court knows, the standard of review under Article 66 Charlie establishes a statutory duty for this court to review de novo a record of trial for legal and factual sufficiency. There can be no factual sufficiency review of an ambiguous verdict when the accused has been acquitted of some of the alleged conduct in the specification, and it is impossible for this court to determine which conduct he has been convicted of and which he has been acquitted of. Under RCM 917, the military judge shall enter a finding of not guilty of one or more offenses charged if the evidence is insufficient to sustain a conviction of the offense affected. The legal effect of a finding of not guilty under RCM 917 is an acquittal. When a specification alleges on diverse occasions and the accused was found guilty to a single unspecified act, the verdict is ambiguous and this court is unable to review for factual sufficiency. There is plenty of evidence in this case that all of the acts alleged in specifications 2 and 3 were committed on more than one occasion. And you'll recall that in specification 2, J.H. said that her buttocks were touched at least twice, once while her underwear was down or partly down and once while up. She testified that her bare buttocks were touched eventually, but not in the first section, in contradiction to her Article 32 testimony, which is substantively admitted. She testified that she recalled a time after the first session being touched on the buttocks where her pants were down but her underwear was up. Similarly, with regards to her vagina, she said that J.H. testified that it was touched twice. At her Article 32 testimony, again admitted substantively, she said that her vagina was touched 3 or 4 times. And same goes for the allegation that the mouth, that her breasts were touched with the assailant's mouth.
Counsel, do you agree with the fact that the government could have charged this case as between on or about 4 October and 5 October, he committed either the sexual assault act that was charged or the sexual abuse act that was charged? And the fact that there may have been multiple touchings within that would not create a circumstance to where a general verdict would be improper. So if they would charge him with, on such and such a date, you touched or you penetrated the vulva of the victim, and the evidence was took place 50 times, that would not create a general verdict at that point, whether the members found it it happened the first time he did it or the 50th time he did it.
I would agree, Judge, but it probably also would have led for the defense to request a bill of particulars.
Right, which is something that they could do in that case. But here they argue that it was one continuous course of conduct in which the majority of the conduct took place a single time during the multiple times that the appellant entered the room and touched the victim.
Clearly, Judge, and that's why we have the problem in this case, is because this court does not know which of those times the appellant was found guilty of.
But why does that matter in a case to where we know on the record what facts went before the members, because even though it was a finding of not guilty, that was not a decision that the members had to make, and that seems to be within Walters. And I know in Rodriguez, CAF went back and made it very clear that we're looking at exceptions made by the members. In this case, there wasn't any exception made by the members based on the judge's findings under Rule for Courts Martial 917. So how do you distinguish that fact, that what went back to the members was only whether or not those acts occurred during that period of time?
When you say those acts, Judge, do you mean
the acts that were charged in the specification, not the diverse conduct? Obviously, that was out from the 917 motion, but the fact that they could have found that he touched her thigh but didn't touch her breast, and they could have rendered a general verdict of guilty on that.
And I think, Your Honor, you are highlighting the problem. Is you're saying they could have done this. They could have done this. And the problem is this court doesn't know. And so since this court doesn't know what the appellant was convicted of, this court is deprived of its ability to conduct an adequate Article 66 review.
But where in the law, if you have multiple theories of liability, does it require the members to come back and specify that period of liability? I mean, that's what's clear in Walters and Rodriguez, that the government doesn't. That's a general verdict. So how is it different in this case when basically you excise the diverse language and we're left with just what the acts were charged over that period of time?
And had the military judge either require the members to state on the record which act they found him guilty of, or if the military judge had said, I have found him not guilty of A, B, and C, then that would put the court exactly in the position where you are. But nowhere in Walters does it, or Rodriguez, does it express or even imply that this would not apply to a finding of not guilty under RCM 917.
Counsel, I have a question with regard to the fact that the judge acquitted of the language of on diverse occasions as part of a 917 motion. My question is, does that affect the analysis under Walters and whether there's an ambiguous finding here?
We don't believe it would at all, Judge. And I think that you could just look at the Walters case to use that as your guidepost, where if the appellant was charged with use of ecstasy on diverse occasions and the military judge had come back and said, I am finding him not guilty of the term of on diverse occasions, it would still be incumbent upon the military judge or the panel to say, this is the occasion for which we have found him guilty. So we believe that the exact same factual scenario in Walters, which we believe occurred here, would extend whether it is a 917 motion or a finding by the panel.
Isn't in this case then the 917 motion, if you're finding someone not guilty, it's because the evidence of that particular occasion is legally insufficient. I mean, no evidence, all inferences in favor of the government would support it. So doesn't that really implication mean that the judge, if they're doing this, would go that far to say which those were that he's finding him not guilty of? And then, because then he's saying the members cannot find him guilty of those occasions, and then would leave whatever else is left for them to make their determination, which apparently is just the one. So I guess what you're saying is the judge should have done more.
Either the judge should have done more or the judge should have instructed the panel to do more. I think the cleaner way, and as we pointed out in the brief, the reason why you never see this is it seems to be such an easy problem to avoid. The cleaner way would have been for the judge to say, I have found him not guilty of A, B, and C. And now it is your job as members of the panel to determine whether or not the government has proven D beyond a reasonable doubt.
But there was no bill particulars in this case, was there?
There was not, Your Honor. Not that I can recall, at least. I can double-check, but I don't recall. Subject to any further questions by the members of the court, that concludes the appellant's proceeding, or at least for now.
Thank you.
Thank you, members of the court.
Senior Judge Dabrowski, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Major Meredith Steer, and along with Mr. Roger Bruce, I represent the United States in this case. The military judge correctly admitted text messages sent by JCH approximately 12 hours after appellant sexually assaulted her as a prior consistent statement under MRE 801D1B. During his cross-examination, trial defense counsel implied that JCH fabricated the allegations, impeached JCH's character for truthfulness under MRE 608C, implied that JCH did not tell anyone what happened to her, and continued to visit appellant's house after he had sexually assaulted her, all with the implication that she was either under any theory of admissibility under MRE 801D1B, she was either testifying out of bias towards appellant and in favor of the government and in favor of investigators, and or out of a motivation of improper influence by another person or event. So while the United States would agree with the defense, that defense counsel never outright during his cross-examination said to JCH, you're lying, you're making this up, you're doing this because you're seeking attention. The fair implication of his cross-examination, which went on for over 2 hours on the record, was that JCH was testifying out of a motivation of bias, which was the reason he was allowed to ask the multiple questions under MRE 608C regarding the number of times that JCH met with investigators and the government and reviewed her statements, and or the implication that she was being improperly influenced by those individuals, or both. So, for example, there is an implication that this was a dream, and it was always a dream, by trial defense counsel. And that was until JCH's mother found her diary and made her go and report what had happened to her. Then JCH and trial defense counsel specifically brought out from his cross-examination of JCH how she told her friend that morning, who was sleeping next to her, appellant's daughter, she told her, hey, I had this weird dream. And then trial defense counsel goes in to admit her Article 32 testimony about having another dream about the appellant and puts on evidence that she has vivid dreams. There is an implication then that this was all a dream and JCH was being improperly influenced by her mother and the government to testify that this had actually happened. Then there was the implication of bias just in the fact that she had told her story over and over again, as was the case in the United States versus Robles. Now, I just want to correct appellant's counsel because the argument in the United States brief was not meant to imply that simple cross-examination under any circumstances can open the door to a prior consistent statement. The argument was intended to show, as in Robles, and as which was based on U.S. v. Morgan and U.S. v. Jones, that when you have extensive cross-examination about the number of times that you've retold your story, that alone can open the door to a consistent statement because of the implication that you are testifying out of an improper motive when you're being influenced by government officials. Further, there was the implication directly by trial defense counsel's cross-examination that JCH did not tell anybody, and specifically on the record at 9:29, trial defense counsel stated, you didn't text message anybody or send any messages on your cell phone in the bedroom that morning, did you? And JCH said, I don't recall. I might have. And trial defense counsel followed up with, well, certainly not about what happened to you, allegedly. And she says, okay, no. The implication being that she never told anybody what had happened to her, and certainly not by text message, when, in fact, she had told her friend a mere 12 hours later after appellant sexually assaulted her, via text message, what appellant had done to her. Now, I think it's clear when you read the record that the military judge did not admit these messages solely because they formed a fresh complaint. First of all, when you read his ruling in the record from 1004 to 1007, he directly incorporates the analysis of 801D1B from the manual for courts martial. In the analysis section, he cites to where Rule 801D1B provides a possible means to admit evidence of fresh complaint in prosecution of sexual offenses, although limited to circumstances in which there is a charge of recent fabrication, for example, the rule, when applicable, would permit not only the fact of a fresh complaint, but also, as presently possible, The entire portion of the consistent statement.
But after he talks about 801, the prior consistent statement, he makes a statement that accordingly the principle of fresh complaint is extended to 801. So that seems to almost put another reasoning for the application of 801D.
And Your Honor, I interpret that as he's saying, and I think this becomes clear when you look at 1008 in the record, the military judge says, JCH can testify, I told my friend what happened to me, as a fresh complaint. And then in accordance with MRA 801, with the prior consistent statements, more with respect to what the report was. And so when you look at that in context with what the discussion section of 801 D1B states, a fresh complaint and the principle of it has been subsumed by 801 D1B, and that is what the military judge was saying. So the fact that JCH text messaged a friend, that is the fresh complaint. The contents of that fresh complaint, those statements, were admissible as a prior consistent statement and comported with all the requirements of 801 D1B. Not that they were fresh, admissible just because they were a fresh complaint, and therefore I don't have to look at the rest of 801 D1B. And so when you look at his ruling, he clearly points to the number of ways that trial defense counsel opened the door to a prior consistent statement based off of bias, based off of a motive to fabricate or testify in favor of the government, and all of which does not require, that the defense counsels stand up and say during cross-examination, you're lying or you're only saying this because the government told you to say it. It can result from an implication of the cross-examination. And that is why this is reviewed for an abuse of discretion, because it's not whether this panel would have done the same thing. It's whether, given the wide range of choices that a military judge has, whether his findings of fact were clearly erroneous or based off of an erroneous view of the law. And in looking at the entire record and the rule and the military judge's ruling in this case, the military judge did not err in admitting this as a prior consistent statement.
Now, if the victim was attention-seeking, as at least the reconsideration the defense at trial alleged, I mean, that clearly could be a part. She's sending the text messages out to her friends to try to get that attention back, see what happened to me, look at me. So could that not be a motive to fabricate?
Yes,
in this
Your Honor.
Case?
Although my recollection in reading the cross-examination, which was extensive, I believe that part of the cross-examination came out on re-cross-examination after the text messages were admitted. So at that point, that's when the trial defense counsel really alleged the fabrication. So I don't think it's fair to say that led to the admission of the text messages, but certainly it took away the ability of the defense counsel to put on that theory that that JCH was fabricating her allegations for an attention-seeking behavior. And if there are no further questions on Issue 1, I'll move on to Issue 2. This court is not precluded from conducting its Article 66 review because there is only evidence that the lewd act specified in Specifications 2 and 3 occurred on one occasion. Appellant seeks to benefit from his trial defense counsel's impeachment to support his argument. However, JCH was clear during cross-examination and direct examination on what her testimony at the court-martial was, and that was that each of the things alleged in Specifications 2 and 3 occurred once. Moreover, appellant is asking this court to allow him to benefit from the reverse position that he took at trial, which violates the principles of judicial estoppel and invited error. Trial defense counsel, when he started out his cross-examination, going back to what I said during the argument on the first issue, he began admitting the Article 32 testimony as it related to a dream that JCH had. So it was clear that what he wanted substantively in front of the members as evidence was the fact that JCH had had a dream about appellant once before. When he moves into his cross-examination, although based off of the Article 32 testimony, JCH made it very clear that when she testified at the Article 32, and defense counsel certainly made this clear to the members, when she testified at the Article 32, for example, that appellant had touched her vagina 3 to 4 times, she said, he touched it 2 times. It was not 3 or 4. And so trial defense counsel said, so that was a mistake. You weren't clear during the Article 32, and now you're saying it was 2 times. And she said, yes, it was 2 times. And again, as the trial defense counsel goes through his cross-examination of JCH, that is the method that he used the Article 32 testimony. It wasn't to put on additional evidence to somehow prove the government's case. And that was clear to both the trial judge and to the senior trial counsel, because when he makes the RCM 917 motion, he says there's only evidence this happened one occasion. There's only been testimony that all of these things happened once. And the trial counsel agreed, and the military judge agreed and granted the motion. So the idea that trial defense counsel is the one that put on all of this other evidence that somehow led to an issue in this case is a little bit ridiculous, to think that the members went back and didn't believe her testimony that each of these things happened one time, but then instead went and used what she said was not the case during her Article 32 testimony to convict him. But moreover, just looking at the facts of U.S. v. Walters, that case involved evidence that was put on before members of six different uses of ecstasy. So there was use 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. And the members came back and found the appellant in that case not guilty of on diverse occasions. So they basically said, we're only finding him guilty of one of these six occasions. That is not what we have here. We don't have occasion X, Y, and Z that appellant came into JCH's bedroom and touched her in multiple different ways as alleged in each of the specifications. We have X. That was the testimony for the members. It happened, although broken out in four specifications, all of these things in the specifications happened once. It started out with touching.
So you're saying happened once, one big global event, or happened actually one time?
One big global event, Your Honor, and as broken out by the specifications, as trial defense counsel started referring to it during JCH's testimony, it was session 1, session 2, session 3, session 4. And so specification 1 of the charge was session 3 or 4. Specification 2 was session 3. Session 1 was specification 3. So each of the specifications aligns with what JCH's testimony was about the different times that he came into the room. So the first time he came in, he started out touching her over the clothing. That was specification 3. He left. He came back. He started going underneath her clothing. That was specification 2. And then he left and came back. And that was specification 1 and potentially part of specification 2 when he used his mouth on her breasts. So it was very clear from the testimony, it's very clear from reading the record what JCH's testimony was, and there's no issue with the fact that the members then came back and found him guilty. Assuming for argument's sake that the military judge, after he granted the 917 motion, should have done something with the findings, I asked this court to look at what that would be and what he would have changed about these specifications. And I submit to you that he would not have changed anything. And again, the members, after they came back with a finding of guilty, once they were essentially faced with, as I argued in our brief, a general verdict situation, even assuming that, if we had asked the members to go back and make special findings, submit to you, their special findings would have looked like exactly what we have right now.
On invited error real quick, I know you mentioned it earlier, and then we'll get to the judicial estoppel, but here the government basically conceded the 917 motion.
Yes, sir.
After the judge made the ruling, before the members announced their findings, the government didn't come back and say, Your Honor, we may have a Walters problem here. We need to try to fix it. So why should we apply invited error when really the error was caused by how the government charged the case, the fact that the government possibly conceded an issue, right, wrong, it doesn't really matter on that. And then basically did nothing to remedy the problem prior to the announcement of findings. So what is so egregious on the part of defense counsel, again, we'll get to judicial estoppel, I know that's different, but what's so egregious there that we should say they invited the error in this point, other than they asked for the RCM 917 motion?
Well, Your Honor, it's the fact that the appellant is now pointing to cross-examination testimony that came obviously by his trial defense counsel through the use of JCH's Article 32 testimony. So it admitted as an inconsistent statement for the substance of it because it was a sworn statement given under oath. But now, and then argued to the military judge at the time and to the trial counsel, there's only evidence that these things happened on one occasion. So I don't think that it was trial defense counsel's aim to put on additional evidence and then somehow benefit from it, but that is certainly what appellant is arguing now, that this additional evidence that creates a problem came from trial defense counsel's cross-examination based off the Article 32 testimony. And that is the invited error. I mean, if anybody caused a problem in this case, it was trial defense counsel standing up, saying there's only been evidence of one occasion, the government agreeing, and now turning around and saying there's actually evidence all over the record that this happened more than once. But when you look at it, what is being offered as this more than once came from the cross-examination.
But counsel, as you just stated, that evidence was offered as substance with no limitations, correct? I mean, the 32 testimony, as you pointed out, was sworn. And so when it came in, the members were free to take it, and the fact finder could take it and look at it and rely upon the substance. And they were convinced that it was credible and reliable, they could find, correct?
Well,
unless they were told otherwise, they couldn't, by somebody, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. I mean, the instructions in this case were not specific as to which statements were admitted on their substance, but I think it wouldn't be proper for me to argue that they weren't admitted for their substance. I mean, the Article 32 testimony came in for its substance.
And the members got no instructions about how to deal with that evidence, did they?
They only got instructions, just the general inconsistent statement instructions. So they were told there have been inconsistent statements that weren't admitted for their substance, and there have been inconsistent statements that were, and the judge didn't break out which ones were which.
So one other question I have about this issue is there any significance to the analysis, the fact that the judge made the 917 motion, acquitted of the on diverse occasions, and how that plays into the Walters analysis?
Well, Your Honor, I think that when you look at the argument of the trial defense counsel, and then you look at the trial counsel's closing argument to the members and everything that happened with the 917 motion, the argument was all of these things, although broken out in these specifications, as alleged in the different specifications, each of these instances happened once. And so the fact that he was found not guilty was simply that the military judge found that the other evidence, if you want to call it that, this Article 32 testimony, was not sufficient to support a diverse occasions finding. So I don't think that when you look at the actual record and what the arguments of counsel were to the members and what the convictions were in this case, it's not as if the military judge simply found that there is evidence of one occasion. And that was based off of her testimony.
Would it be fair to look at this as what the fact finder did? And here we had both the judge and the members doing something as the fact finder collectively, getting to the result where we had being found guilty of specifications 2 and 3 with the exception of the on diverse occasions. So, you know, putting aside how we got there, that's where we ended up. And doesn't Walter say that you have that, and that on-diverse language goes away, is that you almost have a presumptive ambiguous finding. So my question is, why isn't that the case here? And maybe you've answered it in some regard, but I'd like to hear the answer again.
It's not the case here because, first of all, in Walters, you had evidence put on that was then argued to the members as evidence of all these diverse uses, of 6 different uses of ecstasy, and then the members came back with an ambiguous verdict and specifically found him not guilty of, it appears then, 5 of the uses that were put on through the evidence. Here you have the members who were sent back with a general specification that did not permit them to find that this happened on diverse occasions, and they found him guilty of what's been alleged. I think the difference is, just looking at the testimony, is there was not evidence of which the members could have convicted him on diverse occasions. Based off of her testimony, when she says, these things didn't happen 3 to 4 times. This specific thing only happened once. He only put his mouth on my breast once. He only put his finger in my vagina once. He only touched my vagina without putting his finger in once. When she said that over and over again, that this progressed from one incident to another, and these things happened once. So even if you don't want to look at it as a general verdict, just looking at the testimony in the record and performing your Article 66 review, the testimony was clear about what the members were considering.
But if the members were to credit the 32 testimony, it's the way it was presented to them, that still left it possible for them to, you know, I agree, it was hard to distinguish between specific occasions as the way it came out, but just as a matter of argument here, if they credit the 32 testimony where she's saying there's more than one time, doesn't that start to create a concern?
I think when you look at her testimony and what it actually was when the Article 32 testimony was used, the Article 32 testimony was used to impeach her and her testimony on direct examination. And she said it did not happen 3 to 4 times, as I said in the Article 32 testimony. So I think that's a little bit ridiculous to think that the members went back and decided, nevertheless, they were going to believe her Article 32 testimony and not what she was testifying to in front of them.
Yeah, but she initially said, how many times do you remember your vagina being touched? Twice, I believe. So isn't that diverse if they believe her direct testimony?
Well, Your Honor, Specification 1 alleged the touching of her vagina, and Specification 2 alleged the touching of her vagina, so that would support the findings.
I'll go if you don't have anything else on the judicial estoppel. It's an issue that I hadn't at least come across in my time on the bench. So is the government arguing that we should ignore the factual assertions that are being alleged by appellant now, or that we should ignore the entire AOE because of the trial discussion that took place?
Well, Your Honor, I think that it's essentially both. What the appellant is pointing to are the factual assertions to support the AOE. But the idea of judicial estoppel is when you go and take one position at trial and you argue to a judge, there's only been evidence of one occasion, there's not any evidence out there to support diverse occasions, and the government agrees with that, how is the government to foresee that then on appeal, appellant is going to completely reverse his position and say, actually, there was evidence put on by trial defense counsel that this occurred on more than one occasion, and now we have a Walters issue. So I mean, he clearly benefited from not being convicted of diverse occasions, and now he seeks to benefit from exactly what the argument that he made at trial by reversing his argument.
And I know in the government's brief, you kind of lay out there's not really a set test. But some of the federal case law, I know you cited Judge Crawford's dissent, and looking at some of those federal cases, they seem to lay out a test.
Yes, sir.
And one of the elements, the determinative element, they said is the party sought to be estopped must have intentionally misled the court to gain unfair advantage. And it talks about courts will not apply judicial estoppel when a party's prior position was based on inadvertence or mistake. So what is the intentional misleading versus an inadvertence or mistake in this case?
And, Your Honor, I agree that that is – I can't point to something that trial defense counsel at trial did intentionally to try and seek relief on appeal. But – and maybe that's why this is more of an invited error scenario. But certainly that is what appellant is now seeking to do, is say you know, we succeeded in a 917 motion. We succeeded in convincing the judge and the trial counsel that there was only evidence of one occasion, and we put on other evidence of other occasions, and now we should benefit from that because of a Walters issue, and there's somehow ambiguous findings.
Yes.
If there are no further questions, then may I conclude?
You may.
Appellant opened the door to the admission of the text messages under MRE 801D1B by virtue of his cross-examination of JCH. Therefore, the military judge correctly applied the law and admitted the contents of text messages as prior consistent statements. Additionally, appellant succeeded in moving for a finding of not guilty to the diverse occasions language in Specifications 2 and 3. and specifically argued that there was evidence that the lewd acts each occurred only once. The evidence supports trial defense counsel's arguments at trial, and this court may properly conduct its Article 66 review. Therefore, appellant's convictions for sexually assaulting JCH must be affirmed.
Thank you, members of the court. I'd like to sort of pick up and follow the same outline. Your Honors, I'm going to assume, let's assume arguendo, that the government counsel is correct and that the appellant opened the door under MRE 608 Charlie. Bottom line is still, in a temporal timeline, if there was a motive to fabricate in this case, it arose either contemporaneous with the first text message that said, "Are you awake?" or right after that, and certainly prior to the other text messages that were admitted substantively. If she is fabricating all of this, if she is making this up, if she is, you know, if there is something nefarious going on, which the defense specifically stayed away from at trial, if there was a motive to fabricate, it happened before the text messages that came into evidence were sent. Therefore, even under that analysis, those cannot be used as a prior consistent statement.
You know, consistent statements, so under Allison, I mean, they don't have to precede all motive to fabricate. They just have to precede
a motive.
A motive that they're being offered.
Yes, Your
toward.
Honor.
So
that is correct.
Here, if you have, she was basically attention-seeking, and then you had the other issue that somehow she has molded her testimony. And then, and we really haven't gotten into it, when you get into some of the impeachment about, one, for example, is whether she pulled her clothes back on after the accused touched her and then left the room and came back. And specifically, I know the defense counsel cross-examined her that, hey, at the 32, you said you did not pull your clothes up because you were scared. So if we have multiple motives here, would you agree that there may be certain parts of the statement that preceded, but not all of them?
I would agree with that.
Okay. And does that then prevent us from applying 801D to that rule when you have some motive?
I would argue that it precludes you from applying it as it relates to a motive to fabricate, not to the other two reasons, the improper motive or bias, which we do not believe exist in this case, but I did want to make clear from the court from a factual perspective. The government counsel starts their argument with saying that this text message was sent approximately 12 hours later. I would point out to the court simply from a factual perspective that the evidence simply does not support that. The defense did a fairly good job of narrowing this down to happening on a Thursday, whereas the text messages went out on a Saturday. We point all that evidence out in our brief. Unless the court has questions about it, we do not believe it's necessary to go into. And the government, picking up on the senior judge's question, talks about prior bias towards the government as being a method to get in the prior consistent statements. With all due respect, I would argue that in 99.9% of cases, the alleged victim is biased towards the government. That in and of itself is not, should not be a determinative factor for this court. The defense's consistent implication in this case is that this was a dream that had at some point morphed into reality. That was the focus of the cross-examination. And that is what the defense was attempting to point out. So, again, to summarize, the defense does not believe that at any point the cross-examination opened the door for the text messages that the military judge had previously excluded. With regards to the Walters issue, the government says that this was the reverse position of what the appellant took at trial. Actually, it's not. The position at trial and the position on appeal is very clearly that the military judge was required to put on the record which diverse occasions he was finding him not guilty of. That is not at all inconsistent with what the defense did at trial. In fact, my recollection, and I could be wrong on this, but my recollection is that they asked for a finding him not guilty on all of the charges and then went back to the diverse occasions. And the government counsel says two things which respectfully are somewhat contradictory. They point out which specifications the military judge found him not guilty of, and then say, on the other hand, that this was one global event, not one time. Well, they both can't be true. And if the government counsel is able, and she's obviously a very capable attorney, if she is able to say, this is the occasion for which the military judge found them not guilty, so this must have been the occasion for which the panel found him guilty, then clearly the military judge could have and should have done the same thing on the record. We're not trying to do anything different than what the appellant did at trial. The bottom line here is that upon the finding of not guilty, the military judge has an obligation to say, I have found him not guilty of these instances, therefore, panel, you are left with this one instance, and whether or not you believe the appellant is guilty of this beyond a reasonable doubt. Subject to any further questions from the members of the court, this will conclude our presentation for the day.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
Counsel, we thank you both for your arguments. We will render a decision in due course. The court is now closed.
All rise.